court will proceed to the third case, Bogie versus Rosenberg.
I do hope that's gin.
Mr. Greenleaf.
Otherwise, a careful pouring would bother me.
Yes, sir. May it please the court. My name.
You want to raise that? There's a little button that will raise it up underneath. Up the other way. Is that doing worse? Keep going. Making it worse. Hit it again.
There we go.
See that?
Appreciate that. May it please the court, my name is Andrew Greenlee, and I'm here with Robert Sirianni to represent the plaintiff appellant, Ann Bogie. I'd like to first talk about the district court's errors in finding that Ms. Bogie didn't state a claim for the tort of intrusion under Wisconsin law. We would submit that the district court relied on two erroneous findings in support of its ruling on the intrusion claim. First, the district court found that no reasonable person would have an expectation of privacy in the casino at issue here where the filming took place. Now, we frankly believe that there was insufficient evidence before the court to arrive at this ruling. We know very little about the actual contours of the backstage at issue.
What you're complaining about was the pictures.
Right. The film is in the evidence. Right.
You can't see a lot of people floating around in the back.
But if the court reviews it, there is at most three people who are shown in the back. And we know, at least in the minds of the California Supreme Court, in the Sanders decision cited in our initial brief, that the presence of onlookers in a place that's otherwise prohibited from the public, that doesn't necessarily defeat someone's expectation of privacy, at least in under California law. And we would submit that the facts are analogous under the Sanders decision, as here. In Sanders, it was a workplace that was closed from the public. Here, Ms. Bogie alleged that the backstage was closed from the public. There in Sanders, there was the presence of onlookers who could see and hear the conversations at issue. Here, too, there were onlookers who could see and hear the conversations at issue.
How did Ms. Bogie get back there?
It's unclear from the record. We can surmise that she was invited back there. If the general public is not permitted back there and she made it back there, we would surmise that she was invited back there. And, in fact, that's one of the
presumably you all have talked to her, right?
We've talked to her, yes. And in fact, that's what she's indicated to us, is that she was invited backstage to have her book signed by Ms. Rivers. And we would like to know, in fact, how she was selected. There are issues here that could be further developed. What was the motive in selecting Ms. Bogie of all people? And that goes more to the nature of the intrusion and whether the intrusion was highly offensive to a reasonable person, which I'll get to in a minute. I would like to just submit to the court that if you put all the possible places where an intrusion could take place and put them on a spectrum, on the one hand we have Soldier Field and a public street. Clearly, those are public places. On the other end of the spectrum, you have the bedroom, a bathroom. Those places are undeniably private in nature. Here, the backstage, we would submit that it's closer to the private place, although it's really not clear from the record how private. And that's really our point, is that this case, to go out on a motion to dismiss, it needs to be something needs to eliminate an element of her claim, and we don't believe that the opposing side has eliminated all the elements of her claim, and we would ask this court to remand this case for further proceedings on the intrusion. The second finding, though, that the district court relied on in support of its decision is the finding that the intrusion at issue was not of a nature that is highly offensive to a reasonable person. Now, again, the reasonableness standard suggests that this is a question for a jury, and only in extreme cases should it be dismissed out of hand. And our feeling is that the reasonableness flows from three different sources. First, there is the fact that she was invited backstage, was filmed without her knowledge and consent, and as she told us this morning over breakfast, she didn't have her makeup on. She was duped into coming backstage. So there's that. That is offensive.
Duped?
Yeah. Well, duped in the sense that she was invited backstage without knowing or consenting to the fact that she'd be filmed backstage. So in that regard, she was, we believe, misled, and that's offensive to us, and we believe to a reasonable person, highly offensive. The second...
Is it your belief that discovery in this case would indicate that the cameras, the people doing the filming, would not be not be observable to Ms. Bogie?
Well, we know that Ms. Bogie alleged that she was filmed without her knowledge. So the facts aren't in the record as to whether it was a hidden cam, a hat camera, as in some of the cases cited, or whether it was actually a camera person. If it, in fact, ultimately were shown that there were a film crew back there and that she was filmed and with lights and a crew, it would be, frankly, a different case, and perhaps on summary judgment, this case could go out. We don't know that from the record. What we do know is that she alleged that she was filmed without her knowledge and without her consent in a place that the public was not permitted to go. And we believe that if I could just return briefly to the offensiveness here, we believe that the motive is important here. And the cases say that the PETA case that's cited and the Sanders case, they both agree, and the common law is clear that the motive of the intruder is important here. And the motive, frankly, they did it for profit. That could be construed as being highly offensive to a reasonable person. And the third reason why we believe that it's highly offensive to a reasonable person is that it was subsequently disseminated across Wisconsin and across the United States. And we believe that that is offensive without obtaining somebody's knowledge or consent first. Ms. Bogie told us this morning that she first found out about it when she got the Joan Rivers DVD and put it in. And she said she fell out of bed when she saw herself on this DVD, and that's offensive. Now,
so her knowledge of this came about because she purchased a DVD of the show and then realized she was in it?
That's what she told me this morning.
She doesn't allege that anybody informed her she was in it, does she?
No. Well, she doesn't allege it. I should make that clear. I don't mean to mislead the court. I'm going by what she told me over breakfast. It's not in the record that she learned about this when she bought the DVD at Walmart. That's what she told me.
The record is silent then on how she became aware that she was in it.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that's the point. The record is silent on so many issues that we believe this case should be remanded for further development of the factual record. With respect to the appropriation claim, we believe that the language of the statute could not be more clear. And this is on page 8 of our initial brief. The statute defines intrusion as the use for advertising purposes or for purposes of trade of the name, portrait, or picture of any living person without having first obtained the written consent of the person. Now, any living, it's important to note that this is a broadly worded statute. You want to use for the advertising purposes or purposes of trade of the name, portrait, or picture of any living person, you have to first obtain their consent. Now, the district court...
So if you're showing a scene of an individual, say the center of an advertisement or a mm-hmm. film in a baseball stadium, and there are a few people who are visible in the background, you have to get their consent?
Well, there is a limiting principle here.
What is that? That
there is. The statute says that the intrusion must be unreasonable. So, for instance, if there's a crowd shot and you know, they show everyone at Chicago, you know,
social media. No, we're talking about the use for advertising purposes.
That's right.
I don't see that limitation principle in the language of the statute.
The language of the statute says, if you forgive me, I don't have it, that portion of it. It says it prohibits the unreasonable invasions of privacy.
It says the use, invasion of privacy means the use for advertising purposes or purposes of trade of the name, portrait, or picture of any living person without having first obtained the written consent of the person, etc. It does start out with unreasonably invaded, but that's a pretty broad invitation, for example, to make an exception for incidental use or for newsworthy use, right?
Well, we believe that in the case of if something is newsworthy or incidental, then that would be swept away in the unreasonable. It has to be an unreasonable, and that's the limiting principle that we would advocate here, is that if it's not unreasonable, then it wouldn't be actionable. And we believe
so
that
it's okay to consider whether the use is incidental or substantial.
Well, we don't read that language into the – we don't believe that that language is present in the statute. But if the court were to have that overlay –
Wait, just a second. You've got me very confused.
Yes, sir.
In the brief, you were telling me the district court is not free to add these glosses to the statute. I thought you were saying just a moment ago in response to the hypothetical about people in the background that the statutory language about unreasonable invasions of privacy provides exactly that latitude, which is it?
I'm sorry. Pardon me. I believe that there is a limiting principle there, and that the unreasonable, if a court were to find that it were not unreasonable for any purpose, but because it was incidental, or, I mean, a court could conceivably, we don't read that language in there that if it's use for advertising or trade purposes, whether it's 15 seconds or whether it's 30 minutes, we believe that somebody should be, you should first obtain the written consent.
So it's absolute?
It's absolute if it's unreasonable. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You've got me thoroughly confused.
Okay. Let me try to, I would explain it like this. If it is an unreasonable intrusion, that is...
We're not talking about an intrusion. We're talking here about
right.
the appropriation.
Pardon me.
Wrong.
Pardon me. If the appropriation is unreasonable, then that you should get someone's written consent. The statute seems to be clear there.
Is it unreasonable to make incidental use of a person's image?
In a crowd scene, we would say, let's say you're filming New York City, and somebody's name or face flits across the screen, that would be, if you wanted to call it incidental or unreasonable, we would reach the same conclusion, that's not actionable. But to use someone, here Ms. Bogie was, we would submit that Ms. Bogie added value to the film by rehabilitating the image of Ms. Rivers and diminishing Ms. Bogie, her own personal standing in her community. And with that, I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Greenlee. Mr. Jones.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Ms. Bogie's principal argument to you is that you need to send this back so we can have some more discovery. But she's in control of the facts that would matter. She knows what happened in that backstage area of the casino. And yet, even though she's filed one complaint, two complaints, and briefed it in this court and in front of the district court, she has never suggested the type of facts that would, in fact, create an area of seclusion, an area of privacy in that backstage area. Now, we would agree. We're not asking the court to make the big step of saying you can never have privacy in the backstage area of a casino. But we do think the law requires that when you are not in your home on that far end of the spectrum, then you do have an obligation to come forward and allege facts that show that you had a reasonable expectation of privacy in that zone. Now, she could have alleged, if it were true, that the film isn't quite accurate, that it doesn't depict what really happened. That you're not looking at when you look at the film, you'll see a common area. There's coffee dispensers in the background. if it were true that, in fact, this was Ms. Rivers' private dressing room, she would have alleged it. If it were true that Ms. Rivers had said, come back and let's have a private talk, she would have alleged it. If it were true that, in fact, Ms. Bogey had a relationship with Ms. Rivers, that she was an intimate of Ms. Rivers, used to exchanging personal anecdotes, if that were true, she would have alleged it. But she's never done that.
I'm getting old and feeble-minded. Did I recall that she went back for a signature for an autograph?
You remember it exactly right, Your Honor. She's just getting an autograph. What the film depicts is what happened. It's an autograph session between strangers. One of them, a famous person, Ms. Rivers, the other, Ms. Bogey. And you can see the guy that I call Towel Guy. You can see him coming off the stage, and you see his towel in the frame. So there's Towel Guy. That's a stranger, clearly with an earshot of the conversation. Then you see Slickster Guy, the guy with the slicked up hair and the suit. And you see Cop Guy, all strangers. If these people were intimates of Ms. Bogey, and this was almost like a family reunion type of situation, then you're starting to move the needle to an expectation of privacy. But these are strangers. And then you look at how Ms. Bogey talks. She doesn't lean in to whisper. She's standing back, and she's in full-throat agreement, enjoying her time to have a talk with stranger Ms. Rivers. And let me talk about the highly offensive nature. So I think, again, there's no reason to send this back and burden the judicial system anymore. She's had plenty of opportunities to suggest the existence of facts that would create a zone of privacy, and she has failed. So it is futile to send this back. Now, on the highly offensive nature aspect of the case, Ms. Bogey is doing nothing more than echoing the full-throated enthusiasm of that audience. I mean, if you look at the movie, and it's actually pretty good. It got like a 90-something percent on Rotten Tomatoes. And it received an award at Sundance for documentary films. But if you look at that segment of the movie, you see that Ms. Rivers engages in this exchange with a guy who has a son who's deaf. And the audience is clearly on Ms. Rivers' side. Ms. Bogey isn't taking some renegade position when she goes back to talk to Ms. Rivers. She's just doing what everybody in that audience had done. And I think it's telling the suggestion here today, there's no allegation in the complaint that folks or neighbors or anybody came up to Ms. Bogey, has ever come up to Ms. Bogey and sort of taunted her or ridiculed her about her appearance in the movie. That simply hasn't happened. So what you have here is an exchange by Ms. Bogey in full voice, without any sort of suggestion that she's engaging in a confidence, expressing a view, not any personal details, not anything personal or embarrassing in and of itself, but expressing views that were expressed by a larger audience. This simply is not the type of highly offensive conduct that this statute is intended to reach. And I brought my book up here because this is a common law statute, and it uses, and it specifically asks the court to interpret it in view of the common law. And so I would urge the court in reviewing this case, my colleagues ask you to look at Sanders. I'm going to ask you to look at a Ninth Circuit case. And I know that can get judicial eyes rolling in this district when I say Ninth Circuit case. But it's a quasi Seventh Circuit case.
Where is the Ninth Circuit?
Well, because Judge Cudahy sat on the panel. So it's got some Seventh Circuit flavor to it.
And which really was there an American citation that you could use instead?
This is the best. I like this case because it does a couple of things. It talks about Sanders, and it talks about the Ninth Circuit is sitting in just the role you're sitting in, deciding whether to apply Sanders' view of privacy to Arizona. And it talks about how Sanders reflects a California view where California is a two-party consent state. And it notes that Arizona, like Wisconsin, is a one-party consent state. And notes that kind of suggests that there are different privacy interests here. And so the court in the case I'm talking about is the medical lab management case. The court really does a nice job of analyzing what we're concerned about here. Talks about both the privacy interest, or the seclusion prong, and the highly offensive prong. And when you look at the types of conduct, the courts, the common law courts that are collected in books like this, the rights of publicity and privacy that we cite in your library doesn't have it, but your librarian said he could get it through loan. When you look at the types of conduct that courts sanction as highly offensive, this is nowhere near it. Nowhere near it. So we urge this court to send this to affirm the district court on the intrusion prong. No further factual development is necessary. Let me take 2 minutes to talk about misappropriation. Misappropriation in Wisconsin comes out of a case, Hannigan talks about it, the case that we both cite in our briefs, but the misappropriation tort comes about from Crazy Legs Hirsch, famous football player at Wisconsin, athletic director, not so successful, but a great football player. And some folks in Wisconsin, knowing his popularity, had put his name, had suggested that Crazy Legs liked a particular shaving gel. Now, that's a misappropriation. That's what this statute is talking about. If you have a person of notoriety and their notoriety is being used to sell goods, that's what the statute's trying to reach. Now, I thought it was an interesting exchange, Judge Hamilton, that y'all had in regard to, aren't there some limiting principles? Yes, the plain language could be read in very fanciful ways. But again, this is a common law statute, and you look at its roots. Its roots comes out of that Hirsch case. And you look at how it's been applied in other jurisdictions. And in Wisconsin, Wisconsin specifically, through Judge Edelman, who was a former Wisconsin legislature, reads the statute as incorporating incidental use exception. There have to be limiting principles, or the statute would reach so far that you could not shoot documentary movies. And that's why you have cases like the Super Size Me case and the Borat case that we all cite in our briefs that talk about this incidental use. She's in 15 seconds of an 84-minute movie. That's less than half of a percent of that movie. If you watch the whole movie, and if you don't, you could have your clerks do it, ask them after they watch it, do you remember much about Ms. Bogey? She is an incidental part of a work that looks at a serious comedic force in this country. To call it pure entertainment is not to label it accurately. And so we believe, again, that the district court got it exactly right, that this was at best an incidental use, and that she has failed, even though she was in charge of the facts, she has failed to suggest that she has any reputational interest that was used to help make this movie profitable. If the court has nothing further, we submit on briefs. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Mr. Greenlee.
I'd just like to touch on a couple brief points made by opposing counsel. First, he appears to be dressing up a motion to dismiss in the language of summary judgment. Ms. Bogey was in charge of the facts, but all she's required to do is plead a short, plain statement of facts that shows that she's entitled to relief. We believe that she's done so. And with respect to the presence of strangers, the Sanders decision doesn't make any distinction between whether people are known. In fact, the journalist in Sanders was essentially a stranger. She and they were having a conversation between strangers. So we don't believe that the fact that they were strangers necessarily in and of itself defeats her claim. And with respect to the medical laboratory case, that they drew a distinction, actually citing to this court's case in Desnick, between external and internal communications. In effect, if you are in a relationship with someone, as a business relationship with someone, then there's less likely to be an invasion or an intrusion onto someone's seclusion. And here we have an aside, a communication between what's referred to as an internal communication in the medical laboratory case. An aside, someone has been invited backstage, and she expresses a private expression of scorn for someone who is disabled. And it was captured on videotape, and we believe that that's offensive. And with respect to the misappropriation tort, the PETA decision, actually, although it goes against us, is interesting on this point because they distinguish between the tort of appropriation and the right to publicity. They distinguish between those two torts. The right to publicity is something akin to what opposing counsel described in the Crazy Legs case where someone's, let's say, you use Kim Kardashian's image. Well, she makes money off her image, and she's entitled to that money. That's the right to publicity intrusion. And then there is appropriation. And then there is the regular appropriation, like the Roberson Box case, the famous case, where someone is a private individual who wouldn't otherwise have any value in their name. And that's the right to be let alone. Yeah, that's what's being protected there. And with that, we thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Greenlee. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed.